Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for the Education Report and the Making of a Nation, coming up after As It Is.
Hello, and welcome back to another As It Is program. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. Each day, we tell you about our world as it is. Get it? And we help you learn and improve your American English speaking skills at the same time. We do this by using a limited vocabulary. That means we use fewer words, and they are easy to understand. We also tell our world stories a bit slower than the way people speak in normal English. That also is a big help if you do not speak English as a first language. Today we have two stories for you. First, we talk about religion and threats to Christians around the world. Then we'll make an attempt to save the birds. No, not from hunters or pollution, but from buildings. It's an interesting story that will be coming your way in less than 5 minutes. So let's get started with today's program. Here is part one. An international religious group has released its list of the worst countries for Christians to live in. As in past years, North Korea was at the top of the list. But for the most part, the greatest threat to Christians came from an extreme form of Islam. Ann Ball has more on the group and its findings.
Damaris Otson lives in Nigeria.
So on their way home, he met with the Boko Haram.
She remembers how supporters of the Muslim militant group Boko Haram stabbed her husband to death.
I was hopeless. I said, my life is useless.
Her story was presented at the release earlier this month of an annual list of countries said to be most dangerous for Christians. The list is a project of the Christian missionary group Open Doors. David Curry is president of Open Doors USA. He says Islamic extremism was the main threat to Christians in Nigeria and most of the other 50 countries on the list.
The world still does not get it. The persecution of Christians is real. It is horrifically violent.
David Curry says the mistreatment of Christians is a serious issue.
The persecution of Christians is a bellwether for the other human rights issues. When people begin to attack people for the expression of their faith, you see the rest of societal issues start to pop up.
In Iraq, militants have also targeted Muslims, both Shia and Sunni. But Nina Shea of the Center for Religious Freedom says the persecution of Christians in Iraq is different.
There will be, we can be sure, a Sunni and a Shiite presence when peace returns to Iraq someday. We can't be sure that there will be a Christian presence.
The group Open Doors was founded in the 1950s to smuggle Bibles to people behind what was known as the Iron Curtain. Its members worked to secretly send copies of Christianity's Holy Book to the Soviet Union and its communist allies. Today, for the 13th time in as many years, North Korea tops the list of worst countries for Christians. There, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un is presented to the North Korean people as godlike. I'm Ann Ball.
Thank you. You are listening to the Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. Millions of birds are killed each year in cities when they strike illuminated buildings, especially ones covered with a lot of glass. Experts say artificial lights at night are confusing for migratory birds. They often collide with glass buildings, not knowing the light is on the other side. In response, a growing movement to save birds from such crashes has been taking place in cities across the United States. Marcia James has just flown into the studio to tell us more.
There's a bird here. It's a woodpecker.
Lisbeth Fuse is director of a campaign called Lights Out DC. Her team found several dead birds one morning at the base of glass buildings.
Very beautiful.
I see the red head.
Volunteers often travel a 6-kilometer path in downtown Washington, D.C., every day before sunrise. Many of the volunteers are amateur bird watchers. They walk around the sides of buildings, collecting fallen birds before they are eaten by predators or swept away by cleaning crews. Lisbeth Few says the area has many buildings that pose a danger to migrating birds.
Large expanses of glass that were lit at night that have plants inside the building, because if a bird sees a plant in a building and it doesn't perceive the glass and it runs into the windows, and then they're attracted to the light.
The Lights Out DC campaign urges building owners to turn off unnecessary lights at night during peak bird migration periods in the spring and fall.
These are mostly small birds. There's a lot of advantages to flying at night, less predators. There's less thermal upheaval, so they can fly more easily. So they've also speculation that they navigate using the stars.
The Lights Out campaign is now in its 5th year. Lisbeth Few says her group is having some success. She also says one of many federal office buildings has agreed to their request.
Since they've done that, we've seen a 2/3 reduction in the amount of bird fatalities at that site.
Ann Lewis is president of City Wildlife, a group that identifies dead birds through the Lights Out DC program. She says other major cities have reported similar results.
When they had a large campaign in Chicago to get buildings to turn out lights, the bird mortality was reduced by 80% there.
This year, volunteers have collected almost 400 birds in the small area of Washington. The birds are identified, frozen, and photographed.
The purpose of collecting birds is to have proof that it's a problem. And that's also why we photograph the birds. In the United States, anywhere from 100 million to a billion birds are killed by glass collisions every year. That's sad.
The birds are donated to the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of Natural History. Brian Schmidt is head of the museum's bird collection.
The specimens that we get can be used for a wide variety of studies. One example is researchers look at carbon and nitrogen signatures, and they can determine where do these birds hatch, where did they grow up, and why are they coming through our section of the country.
Volunteers hope their effort will bring increased public interest in the problem, helping to save birds and electricity. I'm Marcia James.
And I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. Speaking of birds, what did the duck say when the doctor asked him how he would pay for his medicine? He said, "Just put it on my bill." Bill, get it? Okay, sorry for the bad joke. Now it's time for you to print the stories you just heard and download the audio as a podcast. Then listen again and again and read along. It's a great way to improve your American English. We'll be back again tomorrow. This is VOA, the Voice of America.
The Education Report is next, followed by The Making of a Nation. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
This is the VOA Learning English Education Report. Every year, South African 12th grade students take a test to decide their next steps following the completion of high school. Many students were unhappy with the results of their 2014 exam. The scores were released January 5th. Universities use the scores to make admissions decisions. Basic Education Minister Angie Motshekga announced that the class of 2014 pass rate was 75.8%. That represents a drop of almost 2.5 points from the pass rate in 2013. The meaning of the numbers quickly became a subject of political debate. President Jacob Zuma sees the results as a sign of progress. A presidential statement said, "South Africa is especially proud of the class of 2014, as they represent a special category of learners who sat through their exams as the country celebrated 20 years of freedom and democracy." However, the opposition disagreed. The Pan-Africanist Congress Party said it thinks the results show serious problems in South Africa's education system. The PAC also criticized President Zuma's ruling African National Congress. The Pan-Africanists said they do not think enough jobs are available for young adults who have just completed high school. Nambalela Niatela is a spokeswoman for the advocacy group Equal Education. She said the test issue is more complex than the way either political side sees it. Ms. Niatela said the numbers are only part of the story of education in South Africa. There is also a problem with students who leave school before grade 12. It has been 20 years since the end of the apartheid system of white minority rule and enforced racial separation in South Africa. The government is trying to give all its citizens an equal education. The country established a new education program in 2012. Students who took the 2014 test were the first to study under the program. It began when they were in grade 10. Angie Motshekga said students who do not pass the exam would have a chance to take it again. She said some students may need extra help after only 2 years of the new learning program. Nambalela Niatela said that South Africa should spend more money on improving education. She said she thinks a lack of resources is the root of the systemic problems in basic education. I'm Katie Weaver.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In 1864, the battle at Cold Harbor in Virginia ended a month of fighting by the Union Army of the Potomac. The campaign had brought the army almost to the edge of Richmond, the Confederate capital. But General Ulysses Grant had paid a terrible price, more than 50,000 Union dead and wounded. Confederate losses were much lighter, about 20,000. Grant was beginning to learn an important lesson of the war. The methods of defense had improved much more than the methods of attack. This week in our series, Harry Monroe and Kay Gallant continue the story of the American Civil War.
By the autumn of 1864, it appeared that the North would defeat the South in the war between the states. The Southern Army needed men and supplies. There was little hope of getting enough of either to win. The Northern Army was stronger and better equipped, but it too had suffered. Much of the death and destruction was the result of new military technology.
A new kind of bullet had been invented. It was called the mini-ball. It made the gun a much more deadly weapon. Before the mini-ball, few soldiers could hit a target more than 30 meters away. With the new bullet, they could hit targets more than 150 meters away. Soldiers with such weapons could be put into position behind stone or earth walls. Then it was almost impossible to defeat them.
Most American generals, however, seemed unable to accept this. They continued to use the old methods of attack that had worked before the mini-ball was invented. Hundreds or thousands of men were put in long lines across the front of the enemy position. A signal was given. The men began to march forward. When they got close, they fired their guns. Then they ran at the enemy and struck with their knives or hands. The idea was to shock the enemy, frighten him, and make him run away. As generals on both sides learned, this method no longer worked. The attackers were shot down before they could get close enough to hurt the defenders.
After 3.5 years of fighting, hundreds of thousands of Union and Confederate soldiers had been killed or wounded. Still, the war continued. In the East, Union armies were slowly pushing forward toward their main target. That was the Confederate capital at Richmond, Virginia. In the West, Union armies were slowly pushing deeper into Confederate territory. The Western armies were led by General William Sherman.
Sherman had two goals. One was to capture the city of Atlanta, Georgia. Atlanta was one of the few remaining industrial cities of the Confederacy. The other goal was to destroy the Confederate army led by General Joe Johnston. Sherman's army was stronger than Johnston's army, but the Confederates usually got into better defensive positions. Sherman refused to attack in such situations. It was easier to march around the Confederates and force them to withdraw. This happened again and again.
Confederate President Jefferson Davis began to believe that General Johnston was afraid to fight. He replaced him with another general. Within 2 days, that general attacked the Union Army. The attack began without enough planning. It was based on false information. It was a disaster. In 11 days of fighting, one-third of the Confederate Army in Georgia was destroyed. The remaining force was too weak to defend Atlanta. The city fell.
After capturing Atlanta, General Sherman fought a series of small battles with a Confederate force across northern Georgia. Then he decided to march to Savannah, a city on the Atlantic coast. Before leaving, his men set fire to the city. Almost all of Atlanta was destroyed. Sherman's army would continue to do this all the way to Savannah, Georgia, 350 kilometers away. It cut a path of destruction more than 100 kilometers wide. This campaign would be known as Sherman's March to the Sea.
Sherman said he wanted to make the people of Georgia suffer. He said he wanted to show the people of the Confederacy that their government could not protect them. Union soldiers stopped at every farm and village. They took food and clothing. They took horses, cows, and other farm animals. What they could not take or did not want, they destroyed. They set fire to houses and farm buildings. They burned crops. They destroyed stores and factories. They burned bridges and pulled up railroad tracks. Day by day, the Union Army of General William Sherman cut and burned its way across Georgia.
The army faced little opposition. Small groups of Confederate horse soldiers struck at the edges of the army, but they did little damage. On December 22, 1864, Sherman reached Savannah. He sent a message to President Abraham Lincoln in Washington. He said, "I beg to present you as a Christmas holiday gift the city of Savannah." Sherman's campaign had cut a great wound in the heart of the Confederacy. All that remained were the states of South Carolina, North Carolina, and Virginia. His March to the Sea had a great destructive effect on the spirit of the South.
Sherman's army rested in Savannah for a month. Then, on February 1st, 1865, it began to move north. The goal was to join General Ulysses Grant outside the Confederate capital at Richmond, Virginia. As Sherman's army moved across South Carolina, it destroyed almost everything in sight. The soldiers remembered that South Carolina had been the first state to rebel and leave the Union. They remembered that South Carolina had fired the first shots of the war. This time, against orders, they destroyed the land they left behind. Confederate forces could not stop them.
The same thing happened in the Shenandoah River Valley northwest of Richmond. In the early years of the war, Confederate forces had moved through the valley to strike northern territory. They had invaded Maryland and Pennsylvania and had threatened Washington from there. General Grant decided that the Confederates had used the Shenandoah Valley long enough. He sent some of his men into the valley. He ordered them to destroy everything that might be of use to the enemy. "Eat up, Virginia," he said. clear and clean as far as you can go. Farms were burned. Crops were destroyed. Farm animals were taken away or killed. Nothing was left that could feed a man or animal. Nothing but blackened earth.
Then General Grant sent General Philip Sheridan into the Shenandoah Valley. Sheridan's army battled its way through the valley in the autumn of 1864. It gained victory after victory against a smaller, weaker Confederate force. By the end of the year, Union troops had complete control of the valley. The only Confederate power that remained was the army of General Robert E. Lee.
With the Shenandoah Valley closed to the Confederates, food supplies fell very low. There was almost nothing to feed the soldiers in Lee's army. Wagons would go out each day in search of food. They returned almost empty. More and more Confederate soldiers were running away. Some returned to their homes. Others surrendered to Union forces. Confederate leaders no longer could find soldiers to take the places of those who left. Men would not answer the Army's call. There was, however, a huge labor force in the South that the Army had not called. Slaves.
Slaves had been used to do non-military work for the Army. They had built roads and bridges. They had driven wagons. But they had not served as soldiers. In the North, thousands of free Negroes served in the Union Army, but they received less pay than white soldiers. Confederate lawmakers finally began to discuss the idea of using slaves as soldiers. A bill was proposed that would free any slave who joined the army to fight. Many Southern leaders opposed the bill, even if it would save the Confederacy. Said one, "Do not arm the slaves. The day you make them soldiers is the beginning of the end of the Revolution. If slaves make good soldiers, our whole idea of slavery is wrong."
General Robert E. Lee did not agree. He believed slaves could be made into good soldiers if they believed they had an interest in Confederate victory. He proposed giving immediate freedom to any slave who joined the army. The Confederate Congress passed a bill in March of 1865 to accept Negroes as soldiers. The bill did not promise to free them. By then, however, it was too late. An army of freed slaves could not be trained in time to save the Confederacy.
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley and Christine Johnson. The narrators were Harry Monroe and Kay Gallant. Transcripts, MP3s, and podcasts of our programs are online, along with historical images, at voaspecialenglish.com. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.